Paper 36, section 5, and we got started on section 5. So in the old single column, it's page 402, okay? And in terms of paragraph number, you see how you have the first three paragraphs there in section 5, and then there's a large paragraph break. So it's paragraph 4, which is where we're starting. There's everyone. Everyone see that? It's a paragraph that starts with the seven adjutant mind spirits. Okay. And let me just give a little preface. Since we are, right in the middle of starting up this paragraph. So we introduced the adjutants there at the beginning by just, helping everyone remember to understand why they're called mind spirits, that the, noting that the spirit word is the root word there. And so fundamentally, that's a top-down orientation then, because, we're within the local universe domain, being at eye level, engaged by mind energy. We aren't directly engaging spirit yet. We're, if we were, we wouldn't need faith. We wouldn't need that upward grasp to be reaching up to spirit. So spirit, is effectively transcendent to us at this point. So if you see, spirit being the root like that, okay, it's a top-down orientation. You're thinking about ministry coming down from on high, getting down to the local universe, and in a sense, being spread into a spectrum where spirit is at the top and it's reaching down towards individuality through mind energy. And the farther that reaches down, the more it has to engage that individuality very directly. And sure enough, in order to get all the way down to us, it can't do it in monolithic fashion. It can't do it as a single phase of mind. It literally has to separate into seven phases to get this far down, away from unity, down towards individuality. You're going to have one phase that's reaching down the farthest and is going to basically be coming into relationship with that matter very directly. Everything grading up to that, heading towards, through that spectrum up towards spirit. And we're going to get into the separation, tonight into those adjutants. Everyone knows that in this section you've got the, nice little paragraphs that give you an initial thought about each of the seven adjutants. Let's see, what else might we want to say up front? When you remember how we ended there, we were reminded that the quantitative aspect of the highest two of the seven adjutants, the sixth adjutant, the adjutant of worship, and the seventh adjutant, the adjutant of wisdom, that the quantitative activity of those is not registered in that central installation of the life carriers, like the other aspects are both quantitative and qualitative, but is instead, as they say, registered in the immediate presence of the divine minister on Salvington, being a personal experience of the universe mother spirit. And we mentioned there, I reminded you, that why that has to be, because she's part of the Supreme Creator personalities. You can see very directly how she's going to do that, be the means by which the almighty aspect of the Supreme type deity is going to be created. He's a Supreme Creator, being directly involved in the in creating the almighty aspect of the Supreme. The almighty is the summation. Just think of how quantitative that sounds when you, you know, you think about the summation of the finite. How does she, do that more specifically? I mean, if she's going to be involved in creating deity, a facet of deity, she needs to be deity herself, and of course she is. You know, we understand it very directly that there's mother-type deity and there's spirit-type deity in her nature. And she certainly can encompass the whole of the local universe, you know, and take a hold of that summation as her mother-type deity, that womb of the whole of the local universe, you know, and then be the means by which that gets expressed, into the Almighty. And that mother deity is a vertical phase of deity. Okay? You're going to need that if she's going to be able to sort of project upward into the expression on the supreme level of the Almighty. And it also is working downward. Now we're coming back around where I started. That whole bit of thinking about spirit, you know, and then down to mind. So why you're calling them mind spirits. Mind and spirit are absolutely separated. There's an absolute spirit, you know, the absolute spirit. There's an absolute of spirit, you know, the absolute spirit. That's, you know, the second source and center, the eternal sun. And there's an absolute of mind, the absolute mind. Conjoined actor, third source and center. There is no magic. Those are absolutely separated. So unless something super absolute links them together, there can't be any such thing as spirit coming down in a spectrum like I was just describing into mind. They would be, you know, separate universes, and the mind universe would know nothing of the spirit universe, which would know nothing of the matter universe. They were if they were just absolutely separated. But that mother deity has that super absolute aspect in it. It's coming down from the co-infinite upholder. It's coming down from above the absolute. And it is the means by which, because of its vertical nature, see, in addition, that you can have a relationship of the transcendent spirit to the subordinate mind, not to mention the transcendent mind to the subordinate matter. So, having them mention her at the end there, that's part of that picture, just remembering how fundamental the Trinity, the mother aspect is to making this function as a whole when the seven absolutes would want things to be absolutely separated. Okay. Even to have a personal relationship between the two of us. If I want the fullness of that personality expression, I'm going to use my absolute dimension of my personality, you know, and so is someone else. Well, now we're absolutely separated. Now, how are we going to have a relationship? It has to be something transcendent, yeah, some super absolute fact that's going to allow us to be related to each other, even, you know, I mean, even when we manifest as an absolute expression. That's, again, this distinction is vital, like we read at the beginning there. I repeated at the beginning. Now, that individuality of the whole, the mother, is the only means by which two things can be connected together to transcend how they're separated. Okay, so, I mean, in that spirit, even though we're going to talk about these seven adjutants as being, You know, and a lot of times you're thinking about them almost entity-like. They were like they were very, very separate. Remember, it's all in the context of a fact, the creative mother spirit, that has the means to keep things all together as a whole, even if going super absolute is required. So you're never going to have any sort of schizophrenia going on here. Everything is going to be kept together in a whole. But you have to start by thinking about the parts, understanding what they are, and then you can appreciate the true whole. The true whole is not some sort of a continuous unity that is just whole like by default. It's a harmony. There's distinct individuality, and some master conductor is coordinating all of those players in the orchestra into a beautiful symphony, you know, into this harmony. All right, so let's read a little bit, starting there on paragraph 4, and get into the adjectives more specifically here.
The seven adjutant mind spirits always accompany the life carriers to a new planet, but they should not be regarded as entities. They are more like circuits. The spirits of the seven universe adjutants do not function as personalities apart from the universe presence of the divine minister. They are, in fact, a level of consciousness of the divine minister and are always subordinate to the action and presence of their creative mother.
Okay. So remember how we talked about this, you know, in the very first paragraph when they used the analogy of the adjutants are the quote-unquote children of the universe mother spirit. Okay, we have a similar thing happening here, and we don't want to overinterpret what they're saying. So the seven adjutant mind spirits always accompany the life carriers to a new planet. Okay, but the immediate say, but they should not be regarded as entities. Okay, so what do they mean by a company? It's like, when I hear a company, I think someone's walking along beside me as a separate individuality. Okay, well, yeah, there's a measure of individuality, a measure of distinct separateness to them. But like we've been saying, you don't want to think of them as literally entities, or even more, beings. They're not beings. They're not seven different persons. They're not even seven different entities, seven different, individuations that you can draw a box around that are minded and think, even though they're not personal. You know, say like a mechanical controller, okay? It's distinct individuality, but not a being. You know, so it's an entity. So when they say a company, what should you be picturing? You have this ubiquitous presence of mind energy, and we know there's seven phases within that that are called these seven adjutants. So the life carriers go to a world, and what is the creative mother spirit doing? She's turning her eyes to that world, following those life carriers with her eyes, in her mind's eye, as they go. And she's bringing her ministry down to that planet. So you can probably just think, that easiest way to visualize that is, that you start with a world, and when it's not inhabited, the mind can sort of be above it. Okay, but the life carriers come, and she draws that mind down to be ubiquitously present right there. Now, technically, it already was there, but what are you visualizing in this way? Is it literally being projected down? She's taking her mind, and there's a specific type of life that the life carriers on that world are going to initiate, and she is going to bring mind down appropriate for that life. So out of all the different things that she could extend down within her diversity of mindal ability, her adaptability, she's going to adapt herself to this new world. See, so that, think of that, bringing a company. She's She's bringing a specific adaptation down into relationship with that world, an adaptation of herself. She has to adapt to what's about to be done. Okay? That's her job, to accommodate all that's going to be. None of this, well, you know, I don't want to do that. Okay? Her job is to be, you know, to stay precisely fixed for countless eons, you know, and hold the space of the local universe, you know, and to accommodate all the beings that are in it. She has to continue to accommodate Lucifer even today. She has not withdrawn her mind ministry to him, you know, as a foul a taste as he leaves in her mouth in touching him, she hasn't backed off one, you know, inch. She must accommodate his existence, you know. So she keeps him just as minded as always, you know, despite the fact that he's rejecting, you know, any of the higher aspects of what she's offering. You know, all the other things you can think of like that. Okay, so that's what they mean by that. There is an adaptation of mind that accompanies the life carriers to a new world. Yep.
So since you mentioned that about Lucifer, so then the people that would be in the mansion world, she would still be holding their mind too then?
Yeah, if someone exists, I mean, she's giving a mind. I mean, the only exception in the local universe is if it's a being that is minded by a higher mother, then of course she's not minding them. Some higher mother is giving them mind. But every being that needs local universe level mind, no matter how divine or the antithesis they might be, no matter how immature they might be, I mean, think of all the horrendous things that humans do. It'd be easy for her to prevent that. I mean, if someone suddenly didn't have mind, it'd be pretty hard for them to have the idea of killing someone. But does she? No. She keeps them, she gives them all the mind that they need to carry out exactly what they want to do. She doesn't back it off at all. So that's her job, is just to stay, you know, unmoved, you know, and trust that everything comes out in the end. Her job is not to question giving mind to some benighted individual.
So as Michael, obviously she doesn't give him the mind, but as Jesus she probably did, right?
Right, the adjutant mind.
That must have been interesting.
Not only the adjutant mind that Jesus had, right? I mean, that's right, she's giving him that mind.
That,
and then when he has Marantia mind, she's giving him that mind, right? Yeah.
You know, as Michael, his mind is not.
No, you know, I mean, yeah, you can try to think about it. Like, so what mind womb is Michael in as Michael? See, there's some interesting things you can think about like that, you know, or like an Ancient of Days. What mind womb is an Ancient of Days in? And see, there's obviously has to be some very high mindal wombs for some, you know. So you take a being that's up at the supreme level, something super supreme is going to have to be the mind womb for such a being. Right? Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, but just, you know, that's the whole point, is to start going, oh yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Jesus had adjutant mind, and it's hers, you know. He's putting himself into her hands. Do a good job, you know, mind me well, right? And she says, well, I'm gonna mind you the way Gabriel picked the genetics, and you're just gonna have to go with it. So, yeah, all right, I'll do it. Right? But, you know, Gabriel tried to pick, some reasonable genetics, and she's just going to attune to those genetics, and then he's got to make do with what he's got. she's not going to favor him in any way. He's true man. Going around the normal, you know, things that every human has to confront. Whatever divots he has in his genetics, like, you know, Mary giving him some tendency to maybe, you know, have to pull back on the zeal reins occasionally, those sorts of things. I mean, he's got to deal with all that, right? All right. Okay, so, yeah, just, you know, so and they say they are more like circuits. Now, we haven't been using that. We've been using the phases. It's sort of the circuit analogy. Don't think that you have to use that to understand everything. But just appreciate that that analogy is tossed out there so that, if you're trying to understand something, it's like, well, you know, if I could think about it as a circuit, I could kind of understand what's going on here. That's why they toss that out, every once in a while with things, so that you recognize that that's going to be helpful at times to understand a certain circumstance. And if you say circuit, okay, there has to be a conductor, okay? And there has to be something that's being conducted. So you want to try to think about that literally. It's like, well, okay, we're talking about mind energy. So I could think about that as being the conductor. If I have a literal energy. Now, what would be the phenomenon, the signal, the whatever I'm going to think of, that's going through this circuit, that's modulating that mind energy. And I like I said last time, remember that fundamentally with mind, you have two aspects. If you just say mind, you're saying two things at the same time. There's mind energy and there's mind activity. Okay. You don't have that with matter or with spirit. Okay, but with mind, you have these two, separate aspects. And certainly the easiest way to begin to think about them is that you have mind energy, and then what's being conducted on that, on that conductor or through that conductor is this activity, this mind activity. Okay. And so that sometimes you can kind of just forget about any difference in flavor of mind energy and kind of just think of it as there's sort of just one mind energy and I have seven different activities playing upon it. And when you do that, you can kind of talk about the adjutants a little bit more like they were they were children, they were entities, that they were separate things playing upon one playground or whatever picture you want to bring forward. Okay. Well, that should give us kind of spun up again here.
We're handicapped for words adequately to designate the seven adjutant mind spirits. They are ministers of the lower levels of experiential mind, and they may be described in the order of evolutionary attainment as follows.
Okay, so before you read, just, that one key thing. There's an order, okay? It's nothing. There's a very definitive order here in play, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's the order that they engage a world in the evolutionary process. And ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That's that exact same order is, when you were conceived and you're a single-celled animal, the first adjutant engages, and from then until roughly age 6, as you develop, you finally get complex enough that the second adjutant can engage, and then the third, and then the fourth. It's precisely in sequence. There's no switching order or, simultaneous or anything like that. They come in a definitive sequence. All right.
One, the spirit of intuition, quick perception, the primitive physical and inherent reflex instincts, the directional and other self-preservative endowments of all mind creations. The only one of the adjutants to function so largely in the lower orders of animal life, and the only one to make extensive functional contact with the non-teachable levels of the mechanical mind.
Okay, now, the thing you have to appreciate, and you go through each of these, is you have a mixture. In a very sparse number of words, they're trying to suggest some starting points of reflection, both in terms of what this adjutant could potentially offer to a human, and also what it offers to merely an animal. Or you could say, what it offered to you when you were still pre-human, when it was pre-roughly age six, and you were just using this as an animal origin, you know, phenomenon, not yet human. Okay, and for each of those, you know, if you look on the threefold actuality chart, it's why when I put the adjutants on this chart, and you look like here in the matter block, in the top block, and you look, here's the spirit of intuition. And after that, in parentheses, I have a little addition of, I say, instinct. Yeah. I won't hold this up every time, but I just want to hold it up for the people on the webinar. If you have a threefold actuality chart in front of you, or if you don't, you can grab one quickly off in the library on the website. I'm gonna bat, you know, back and forth the name that we said last time. Remember that they got from Isaiah 11. You know, those primary names: intuition, understanding, courage, etc. That they've taken from second and third verses of Isaiah chapter 11, right? And we want to both understand why they did that, you know, how that works, and also, another word to help us to get an initial understanding of each. Okay? Now, as the spirit of blank, that's not animal anything. No animal has the spirit of courage or the spirit of knowledge or the spirit of counselor. I mean, they don't have a relationship with spirit. They don't have the full spectrum of mind that can get up there and play with spirit above. You know, they've got a gap of the sixth and seventh adjutants at least. Okay, so the spirit of names are just for you as a human. Okay, if you're taking delight in, you know, functioning as a human, you could be the spirit of courage. Yeah. And if you very personalize that, you can even do like I did on the chart and put a capital S on it and a capital C on it. And, you know, you could use it as an alternative name for yourself. I am the spirit of courage, capital S, capital C. If I've, you know, really fundamentally taken a hold of that and I'm the master of that thing, I wield it as a personality expression now. Okay. But initially, what's the deal with, okay, the spirit of intuition? Now, that quick perception, remember we talked about that, how they were taking the third verse in Isaiah 11 out of the King James Version, the quick understanding one, and modifying it to quick perception, and then going to spirit of intuition. Okay, why is it the spirit of intuition? It's because each of these adjutants has an aspect of what you have in a holistic sense when you don't have minds so fast, you know, so split up into these different phases. So when you think about your spiritualized mind, think about that little measure of spiritualized mind in the upper domain of the hourglass that you're given by grace, where these seven phases are functioning in a unity-like fashion. Spiritualized, you know, unity-like, less broken up. There's an aspect within that consciousness, that, you know, genuine personal consciousness, that does the thing that we often call recognizing. Those three cosmic intuitions are a recognition, you know, like a recognition of the fact of things, a recognition of the fact of meanings, a recognition of the fact of values, etc. We often describe that as a recognition, those intuitions, those insights. So they're saying, see, this is a way downstepped shadow of that recognition fact, you know, in your higher mind. The revelators actually give a precise name for this at one point. They say, now when you're starting to think about your subjective consciousness and you're thinking about, you have sensory inputs. Okay, those come in literally through a material mechanism, like nerves and brain and things like that, okay? And, in ways we don't want to try to get into right now, you know, it ends up being a form in your mind, so it crosses that gap between matter and mind, which are absolutely separated, okay? But it ends up resulting in a form in the mind energy system, and you have to be able to go, I'm aware of this form, Okay? Now, you don't need to be objectively aware of it in some sense yet, but you have to have some sort of subjective awareness. And they call that sensation recognition, sensation hyphen recognition. You know, just that rudimentary ability for you to recognize the existence of a form in the mind and then respond to it. You know, like, very mad dog, run, you know, or something, okay? Carnivore approaching, you know, run. You have to be able to, you know, be aware of that form. So, see, they're pointing out that, see, fundamentally it's the first adjutant. The one that's down there, like Gene read there, the only one to make extensive functional contact with the non-teachable levels of mechanical mind. See, obviously from the matter up through the mechanical mind, this form comes. And the first adjutant is right there to be aware of the form, that sensation, that form in the mind, tied to that sensory input, and have a sensation recognition. Okay. And like I was saying, the whole, I think I should run sort of thing, that instinctual. You know, you notice they mentioned the primitive physical and inherent reflex instincts.
Versus prey. Which would not be necessarily.
Yeah. The directional and other self-preservative endowments, etc. So, I mean, you can see why the alternative word there is instinct, okay? And when you say that, I mean, in some higher sense, you could say it's a spirit of instinct, but appreciate those alternative words, that's when you don't want to bring in the spirit part. You just want to think about as an animal origin creature or what an animal does, you know, what does the fly that's flying around in this room and pestering people, you know, it's using the first adjutant. Is it using it as the spirit of intuition? No. It's using it as the energy of instinct. You know, it's just an energy, particular flavor of energy phenomenon. Like I pointed out, it's a they said in advance of this, it's a differential urge.
It doesn't okay. have much genealogy. it syncs with the genes, right?
Right, so you have that first adjutant just syncing up with its DNA, you know, that fly's DNA, and it has, you know, it has sensation recognition, you know, its eyes are picking up things, and it, you know, there's a little form in the mind energy system, and it responds to that, and okay, interacts with the environment through that, you know, that mechanism. It's just the energy of instinct. Okay, and it is technically teachable, mind, even as that first adjutant, but obviously in a lower life form, there's only a minimal level of teachability. The first adjutant has just a limited engagement with such a limited organism. And so most of the teachability is used up by just attuning to the genetics. And don't expect a creature that, you know, those lowly, you know, like insects and things like that, that only have the first adjutant, don't expect them to be, you know, trainable to, you know, to a very high degree, okay? Above and beyond their basic stuff. Yeah, maybe a little bit, but see, most of their capacity to be taught is all used up in just attuning the mind to it, and it's taught
they
it.
They seem to jump real quick when they grab that fly swatter.
Okay, they react, okay, but did you teach it anything? Probably not. Okay, see, okay. Now you know there. You know we know that you know you. But just you know try to separate that. Separate you know what it's just doing as an energy of instinct. It's just attuned to the genetics, right? And so it just has that ability. It doesn't have to learn anything to start doing that. And what it might actually learn. All right.
Before you go on that particular one,
yep.
Are we that way also? In other words, as the spirit of intuition, you know, reacts to us or, you know, engages us.
Engages us, yeah.
Does it engage us as a spirit in that case versus a differential as an animal?
No, yeah, okay, so good point.
Before we get to be, you know, six or before we get to...
okay, so... Yeah, I know what you're asking. So, yeah, I mean, let's flesh that out a little bit. So certainly at the moment I was conceived, and all I was a single-celled animal. It's just going to be a minimal necessary engagement of the first adjutant. But all these adjutants have a very high spectrum. Like, think about how much more the first adjutant would have to function in a material son or daughter compared to even me. You know, let alone when I was a single-celled organism, how much it needed to do for me. So, you know, there's a whole spectrum for all of these, you know, sort of a vertical spectrum. And as you're maturing, you know, and other adjutants are coming in, that first adjutant is going to be able to engage in a more and more significant way. One of the things that it'll start to be able to do is to not just engage a single cell, but to engage a collection of cells. And that's going to be really important. The moment, you know, I'm one cell, and then I'm two cells, and then I'm four cells. And, you know, when I get to the point where my cells start to specialize, it'd be nice if I had a mind ministry that was a little less just ministering to each cell as an individual cell, like I was just a colony of single-celled organisms, and I could pull one out, and it can function independently, and I can stick it back in a colony, like some simple animals are. You know, they don't have any specialization of cells yet. They're still just amoeba-like single-celled organisms. Okay, but as soon as I have differentiation of cells, I said, you know, it'd be nice if the first adjutant can engage those collectively as well as individually. And each of the adjutants also has that. It's kind of a higher level of expression where, you know, and that's how one of those colony animals works. You know, when they talk about the overcontrol of evolution, remember they alluded to that at the beginning of this section. You know, that's, you can see in the evolution, the first adjutant is only functioning to individual cells. And then things get sophisticated enough where it can begin to function in its collective mode. And you literally have then these colony organisms can be over-controlled. See, by that higher engagement of the first adjutant and all the way on up. All the adjutants have that. They have an individual mode and an collective mode. And they also have a whole spectrum of each of those. Higher and higher levels of collective functioning, higher and higher levels of individual functioning. So all of that complexity is in play. And initially for us, yeah, I mean, they're not functioning as a spirit of anything until you know, have the seventh adjutant and encircle it. So they're all just the energy of something to begin with. And of course, I'm not very personal right now. So there's a limit to how much they're ever going to function as the spirit of something in this life. Okay? There's limits. I'm not going to live long enough for them to get to the mode of being the spirit of something like they can with a material son and daughter, say. So there's that. And let's see. And I think that's. We'll get some other things here as we go forward. Some other. Is there a question? Okay.
Yeah. Does the spirit of intuition exist in any other life forms other than animal?
Okay. So remember we talked about this a while back. You know, why do you have two definitive kingdoms of life? The plant kingdom and the animal kingdom. You know, what's the fundamental difference? That's just so completely obvious that even the crudest of biologists could start to separate things like that. Plants only have mechanical mind. To be an animal, there has to be at least the first adjutant engaging it, in addition to the mechanical mind. So I have mechanical mind, okay, and then I have the first adjutant, on top of that the second, etc. So animals have adjutant mind, plants just have mechanical mind. Because plants have to be able to, respond to changes in the environment. They have to have a way to interact, but they don't have any consciousness.
They have adaptability.
They can adapt. They can respond to changes in the environment. That's because they're minded. Okay, but in order to have consciousness, you have to have some measure of hierarchy. You know, if I'm an amoeba, I have mechanical mind and first adjutant. Well, from my first adjutant vantage point, I can look down upon the mechanical mind and have a consciousness of that fact, of the existence of that. I can't see, I'm a drop of water in the ocean in terms of my first adjutant nature, so I can't really see that, not conscious of that, but I can be conscious of the mechanical level. If I have the first two adjutants, I can't really see the ocean I'm in as a second adjutant eye level, but I can see a first adjutant self and a mechanical mind underneath that. Okay. So in order to be conscious, there has to be some sort of a transcendence, you know, to some degree, so that you have a higher vantage point, you know, to be in relationship with and be conscious of that. Otherwise, you're an unconscious drop of water in the ocean. Okay. You have no differential to you know, have awareness.
He's asking, where does mechanical mind come from?
And we'll get that in a second, but it comes from the master physical controllers, or the ones that minister it. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. All right, so let's go to number two.
Two, the spirit of understanding, the impulse of coordination, the spontaneous and apparently automatic association of ideas. This is the gift of the coordination of acquired knowledge, the phenomenon of quick reasoning, rapid judgment, and prompt decision.
Okay, so again, it's only the spirit of understanding, potentially, in a human. The energy, it's the energy of rationalization. Now, don't think some high human wrapped around the axle rationalization scheme when I say that. But what most fundamentally do you mean by rationalization, to rationalize? It means it's just the energy nature of it, that differential urge, just what it does because of a kind of an energy it is, it will connect dots. If you put two things, you know, in its awareness, it'll try to connect the dots. It's an fundamentally associating energy. You can't help yourself. You will connect dots. If someone throws anything at you, you'll try to rationalize it. You'll try to, you know, put a line through it and say, you know, it looks like a clown or whatever, just like the old dot-to-dot things, you know, you did when you were a kid. Right. I mean, it's the second adjutant. That's right. You can't turn that off, and that's one of the most rudimentary aspects of incessant clamoring. Okay, you just can't help yourself. You want a rational. You know, rational means, you know, that you're taking two juxtaposed things and you're relating them, and then you're, you know, relating the next two and then the next two. Okay, just like a ratio, rational. Okay. You're taking things in pairs, and you're deductively stepping along. Okay, so you see them, you know, mentioning things like that, association of ideas. Now, technically, an idea is a sensation plus the reflective interpretation of a personal self. You know, the revelators define that for us. Okay, well, no animal has a reflective interpretation with its personal self of a sensation. Okay, see, no animal can technically have an idea. Okay, all right. So when they say things like that, association of ideas, okay, that's just, you know, in a human mode. But, you know, even, you know, a fish with the second adjutant is associating things. Okay, it's using the second adjutant to connect the dots. When the second adjutant attuned to its genetics, part of that attunement wasn't when you see a shadow over your fish bowl, go up because food is about to hit the surface. That wasn't part of its initial teaching via its genetics. Okay, but it doesn't take the little goldfish long to associate shadow with food about to be there. And so, you know, before the little things of food even hit the surface of the water, where there might be some chemicals that could go through the water and it could somehow sense them with that nose or whatever. No, I mean, before they hit the surface of the water, it's right there with its mouth open and grabs them, right? Because it figured out, it was taught, okay, to associate that shadow over the bowl with food about to be there. Okay, it has teachable mind. That's the second adjutant, associating those two facts. Okay, something you desire, food, with shadow that you don't understand. Okay, there's no spirit of understanding to the phenomenon. It doesn't understand what's going on, but it associates it. So it rationalizes it. It connects the dots.
Would it has. Say that's Pavlov?
Right. I mean, any of that sort of, yeah, right. Pavlov's dog sort of things is just right. Just you're just teaching a basic associative things. Right. You're using, that's the second adjutant.
Very, very, very strong in the horse, the higher animal, because they can recognize and hear things and know, you know, sense things that a human doesn't even know that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're so quick. So the quick perception, you know, is for self-preservation, of course, for the animal.
Sure.
But then the spirit of understanding too, you know, is really strong in that animal as well, because all you have to do, like, if you want the animal right. to go a certain direction, you just touch the side of their
right.
body,
right.
and they immediately know to go that way. I mean, they're so well trained.
Right, and they don't have any understanding of the whole phenomenon in some vague context or anything. They just, you know, it wasn't instantaneous. It took a little bit of, you know, more definitive getting them to associate, but once you have them definitively with that association, all you have to do is just touch the one side, and they know, you know, they respond, they know that that's what you want them to do. They've associated those two very definitively, right? They've been taught. Yep.
Is mind that humans have spirit driven, or just conscious drive at first?
Again, like I was saying, I mean. It's sad to record that almost no one on the planet uses, you know, our mind from the top down. Most of what we do is very bottom-up use of mind. So it's, by and large, energy. And the extent to which, you know, you're using the adjutants as energies, you know, rather than as the spirit of something, and hence where there's personal, you know, nature involved, is the extent to which someone can, you know, even on that installation on the life carrier headquarters world, could dial you up, look at the exact quality and quantity of your usage of each of the adjutants, jot it down on a notepad, and calculate what you're going to do 5 years from now. I mean, you're just a machine. I mean, and simply calculable. You know, it's like, well, okay, the personality question mark in the equation is negligible. So, they just calculate what you're going to do, and you do exactly that, you know. So you want to be humble about this, you know, and begin to separate self-assertion, your urges as an energy system, from any will. You have some very profound urges that go all the way up to the seventh adjutant that we love to anthropomorphize and call free will exercising and stuff. It's nothing of the sort. It can be calculated in 90 decimal places 20 years in advance. You know, what you're gonna do. Remember, the moment that you're conceived, they look at the DNA that's there, you know, calculate most of your life, send the equations to Divinington, and they build a little simulator so your adjuster can practice, you know, functioning in your mind, you know, over the course of your whole life. You know, and it's sad to record that they don't have to adapt much. Okay? Pretty much all the way until the day you die, it's just like it was in the simulator. Okay? But you were thinking, man, am I so free will? Man, I did all of these incredible... No, you were just totally calculable. Your adjuster will explain this to you one day. Just how little unpredictable unpredictability you had, you know, during this life. Okay? Okay, so that energy of rationalization, that energy of that basic associative, and remember, we have, like I have on the threefold actuality chart, you've got adjutants 1, 2, 3, individuality, associativity, unity. Okay, and so we're seeing that, you know, that very much just that individuation, say, that has to be, you have to be aware of, you know, going to something that's connecting two of those dots that you're aware of. You know, so first you have to have the dots, and then you put the line between the dots, okay? And then there's going to be some sort of a vague unity context that you're going to put those connected dots into with the third adjutant. Okay, but let's not leave the second one quite yet. You notice how much they're implying the you know, what this is a shadow of in terms of a more unified, higher, spiritualized mind. Things like the impulse of coordination, okay? Okay. I mean, it's one thing to associate, you know, it's a very linear thing. But to get up into a holistic space where you're starting to strike step with the wholeness of the mother, and you can coordinate things, you can see them in a whole, you can see the whole symphony in your mind. Okay? Okay. See, they're telling you that this is a faint little shadow, even down in a goldfish, of that higher fact. So it's an impulse, it's trying to punch you upward to genuine coordination. It's not coordination, but it is the impulse. It's trying to punch you up to where true coordination lies. Just like the first one was trying to punch you up to where true recognition lies, objective recognition. Okay. It was an impulse like that too. You know, again, you know, especially coordination of acquired knowledge. Okay, that's, you know, that's full on human stuff. Okay. But, you know, people, you know, I mean, some of them, you know, just quick reasoning. I mean, right, an animal needs to be able to quickly connect the dots and, you know, and react. If it's something that goes beyond just recognizing dot and reacting to dot, but maybe it needs to react to what happens when you connect two dots. Okay, and then it needs the second adjutant, and it needs to do it quickly. All first three adjutants are in the moment adjutants. They do everything quick. They're just in the moment. You know, that's why I have that annotation on there, on the chart, in the moment. Yeah. you know, and just notice that with when you say the human words, it, you know, it starts to smack of something that's a little bit more out of the moment. I mean, understanding, you know, doesn't feel quite so, yeah. That's just because you're bringing in a little bit more eternalized human. But rationalization, okay, that can just be just purely in the instant that you connect two dots. Yep.
One more question. Mm-hmm. When we decide to go do something, do we get values at that point? I'm not quite sure.
Well, I mean, at this point, let's try to understand ourselves as animal origin, rather than quickly trying to make ourselves human. I mean, it's actually kind of important, you know, that's why they're giving you all this, so that you can understand what you're trying to master. You know, if you immediately say, okay, but I'm a human, and so I don't have to worry about it, all that stuff is taken care of from, you know, I'm sort of self-harmonized or something, you know, because I have spirit and it makes everything a unity, you know, see, that's delusional. No, you have to take a hold of each of these impulses and become their master. Especially the higher up we go, the more important it is for you to not thinking that it is taken care of automatically. So, you know, rather than me addressing kind of what happens more in the human context, let's just try to appreciate our animal origin nature. It's just, you know, we'll see hints of our humanity as we're going through. You know, we have the potential to coordinate acquired knowledge. But before we can do that, we have to be able to just connect dots, you know. So if you think that the tendency for people to rationalize is like, well, that's something that's got to be suppressed, and that's obviously evil. It's rationalization tendency, especially, you know, in general, men have a greater tendency, you know, to get fixated on their second adjutant than women, you know, and there could be a tension between the sexes because of that. Why do men have to always try to connect the dots? Why can't they just be present with it? you know, just, I mean, that's one thing, but, you know, it really gets problematic if you start to bring in some sort of a religious, some ideological notion where okay, when you're talking about that self that needs to be rejected because it's inherently evil, and I want to somehow transcend my, you know, self and become pure spiritual, you know, that rationalization thing, well, there's, you know, that's the poster child for what it is I'm trying to liberate myself from. Oh, okay, so you think that what God gave you is flawed, has no ability to be uplifted, and you certainly don't want to be able to coordinate knowledge as a human. So you're going to turn off that adjutant. Does that sound wise? No. You know, the very fact that you think that demonstrates to me that you aren't really using your seventh adjutant. I don't see much spirit of wisdom there. Okay, that you would have that religious notion, that yourself and those lower urges that it has are fundamentally, you know, wrong, evil, to be rejected, or whatever. I'm generalizing. You know, that's a case in point. I mean, think about all the ideological religious notions where, you know, we think of the flesh as evil in some way. You know, and you're trying to somehow liberate yourself from the urges of the flesh. You know, urges like sex, say. Can you think of a religion that has issues with that urge? I think it's probably not too hard. All right, we're talking about any of these basic urges, you know. We think that there's somehow something that we're doing wrong. No, God put that urge in you. Okay? It's not evil. If it has issues in relating to others, that's your fault. You haven't mastered it. You need to take a hold of it and master it. That urge is for something. It's not automatically directed. It's not automatically the spirit of anything. It's just an urge. It needs to be directed so that it can be the spirit of something. All right, let's keep on here.
Three, the spirit of courage, the fidelity endowment. In personal beings, the basis of character acquirement and the intellectual root of moral stamina and spiritual bravery. When enlightened by facts and inspired by truth, this becomes the secret of the urge of evolutionary ascension by the channels of intelligent and conscientious self-direction.
Okay, now that's an interesting one. Notice how biased they were to the human side of the picture there. It's all, and I mean, even like really grand scale, human things of, you know, an ascending sun sort of stuff. Okay, so let's try to understand a little bit more of the basic energy fact that's going on there. On there I have loyalty. I say it's the energy of loyalty. Now, yeah, I could, in a personal sense, it could be the spirit of loyalty too, but let's just think about it as the energy of loyalty. Okay, so the fidelity endowment. Okay, now, fidelity, okay, that's the same root as faith. Okay, so fundamentally you're talking about a personal thing there, to be faithful, okay? But, you know, it's like, well, what's the energy core of faithfulness? You know, even the dictionary will give you the clue, loyalty, okay? If you think about the core energy fact, an animal can be loyal. An animal can't manifest fidelity, and an animal can't be courageous, but an animal can be loyal. There's an energy. That's just a, you know, it's just a simple fact of what that energy does. Is that in a living being, it will manifest this thing that we have a word for, loyalty. You know, there's no profound spiritual whatnothing going on. It's just an energy fact. Loyalty is a simple energy fact. Okay, so all of the loyalties that you can, you know, that you demonstrate in just that basic mode in your entire life, all those are calculable the moment you were conceived. That's just a simple energy thing. It's not some unpredictable, profound thing that you might think it is. It's just an energy fact. Okay, so now the thing I hadn't brought up here yet, it starts to really come into play when you get this one that has the more unity-like aspect in play finally. You know, just when you say courage, okay, you're starting to talk about something, you know, we like to anthropomorphize and say a dog has courage, you know, because, see, it has this more unity-like thing of loyalty that smacks of something profound. We start to feel the spirit-likeness of the phenomenon, okay? But now as loyalty, if you just think it in the energy mode, it's not, like I said, it has no inherent direction in it. So loyalty in what direction? Well, I could be, as a human, I could direct that very definitively rock solid upward and have an unshakable loyalty to God. Or I could let it just be wandering around undirected, and It finds all kinds of fascinating things going on, welling up from my genetics. I should be loyal to my baser genetics. Like, I should be really loyal to that sex thing, say, or something like that. You know, I should dedicate, you know, my whole life to, you know, being loyal to those urges. Okay? You know, or any other, you know, urge down there. Okay? All right, see, so loyalty can obviously, you know, forget about going sideways, but just, you know, simple, can obviously be pointed up or down. You know, courage, though, no, courage is definitively upward. You know, if you're courageous, no one is thinking of you as being somehow fixated on your navel, you know, and your basal material urges or something. Everyone knows if you use the word courage, you're turning away from your navel and saying, well, I think I need to die, you know, sacrifice myself in this circumstance for the greater good. Okay? I mean, that's a definitively upward thing. See, the names like spirit of courage or spirit of understanding or spirit, that's when the arrow is pointing up. It's been, the spirit has come in, spirit dominates mind. It's taken a hold of that mind energy and oriented it upward. Now, of course, the only reason it does that is because your personality has taken a hold of the spirit and oriented it upward, but the mind then follows that upward orientation, okay, in suit. Okay, but rationalization, I mean, is that necessarily upward directed? No, I mean, yeah, I could go any direction, you know. You know, or just, I mean, just saying instinct, that, it's like, wow, that one kind of just seems like it's always sort of just pointed right there. Yeah, I mean, that, there has to be one that is basically keeping an eye on the foundation. You don't want that one to wander off too much. Now, the exception is the female. Okay? The female can't be just focused on her navel, or children will die, okay? There has to be a maternal instinct. So one of the differences between how the first adjutant engages a male and how it engages a female is by grace, the first adjutant engages a female with a measure of definitive upward orientation by grace. You don't have to choose to orient it upward. It's put upward by grace so that a female has a maternal instinct, okay? So that children don't die. You know, if a female is too selfish, you know, the species won't, you know, go on. So at least one of the two sexes has to be, you know, have a, you know, hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. I mean, you have to, a female has to be given an upward orientation to the first adjutant by grace. You know, but you don't need both of them. And, you know, if you think about it a bit, it's obvious, you know, why it's handy to have one of the sexes that, you know, doesn't have that, you know, can actually take its eyes off the child and notice, holy cow, you know, I think that's Genghis Khan and he's riding right at me. I should pick up my sword, okay, or my spear.
Or children will die.
Our children will die. All right. So, right, you know, this complementariness. But it's very important to recognize that, you know, that first adjutant has this definitive by grace upward orientation in a female. Now, in a male, you know, we mentioned how they do in general have a tendency to like to play with their second adjutant a lot more than a female does, and get caught up in rationalizing everything, I'm being too analytical. But, you know, loyalty, ours is not to question why. Ours is but to do and die. You know, see, there's a measure there in a male by grace. You know, the male has to just be immediately comfortable with that. Or again, there's not going to be soldiers, or there's going to be saber-toothed tigers eating babies. Right? So, you know, you have these initial little biases of grace that are built in to try to get it going and get it perpetuating until there can be enough human consciousness and awareness of this where you understand what's going on, you know, and can make these decisions yourself. Okay, so that's, you know, And then, you know, just when you think about the other things that it says there, you know, about, you know, impersonal beings, the basis of character acquirement and the intellectual root of moral stamina and spiritual bravery and all this, okay, those aspects are very important, you know, to appreciate that when you go individuality, associativity, unity on the chart, adjectives 1, 2, 3, when you get to that first one that has significant unity likeness innately in its energy urge, in its energy nature, you have the foundation of your personal nature as a human. Personality is spirit pattern. So if you think about high and low, what kind of spirit you're going to have associated with you, the foundation of that whole spiritual or quasi-spiritual nature is that third adjutant. Okay? You know, and that's why, you know, when they're talking about Lucifer, for instance, you know, or in general anyone, if you choose to use that energy of loyalty in a actively, you know, willfully negative mode, what are you doing? You're knocking the foundation out from underneath your whole spiritual, you know, nature, spirit pattern, personalized. And that's why they say, and when you do that, it's not too likely you're ever going to recover your personal quality. It's probably the beginning of the end for you. It may be a long downward, you know, descent, but it, you know, you've just knocked the foundation out. You know, to be disloyal, consciously disloyal to someone, is to choose to sever your foundation and begin to have your whole personal nature crumble. Okay.
Now, so, as mortals, we'll have these seven adjutants throughout our Maranta career?
No, not through your Maranta. I mean, as soon as you die, you're disconnected from these.
Okay.
You have Maranta mind. But like we said, even though you just have one phase of mind then instead of seven, especially your early Maranta mind, think of it as having those seven different phases kind of inside of it. They're not as separated, but they're still there because you're still working on bringing them together into harmony. You're still trying to work your way up the psychic circles, okay, unless you fuse in this life. Right?
I was thinking of the magnitude of mortals that were lost on the mansion worlds to the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Would that, what you just said about if you lose that or turn that third adjutant downward,
mm-hmm.
you lose that foothold.
Right, and see, and this is just, I mean, think about how problematic this could be if you're in a very definitive situation and you have a choice in front of you. What direction do I point my energy of loyalty? Do I direct it to God the Sevenfold or to the God of Liberty? Do I direct it to Michael, who is incarnate, standing in front of me, or not? Remember what Jesus said, about those who, it's like, you don't understand what you're doing, okay? God is standing right in front of you now, and you're choosing to direct your loyalty away from God. It's not likely you will recover from this.
Father, forgive them.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing for the ignorant, those who know not what they do. But those who know that not, there could be no explanation for what they're observing, except that this is indeed who he says he is, the Son of God. And I'm going to choose to direct away from that, knowing that that's the only logical explanation. Okay, that, you know, to those handful, he says, this is probably it for you. Okay, there's only iniquity now, ahead of you. Those very definitive things. I was just going to quickly, if I could find it, let's see if I can find that real quick. That comment they make. I should have thought of that in advance. somewhere in, you know, up there in the Planetary Rebellion paper, I think it was, I thought it was early on here, is where they make that comment about, you know, how catastrophic it is to your personality integrity, you know, if you willfully misdirect the third adjutant. Sorry, I can't find it right off the top, you know, right, just flipping there. But you got the spirit of it. I mean, you can just understand that there could be a sentence like in there, just mechanically, you know, this is the foundation of your spiritual nature. You knock it out and, okay, you got serious issues. Okay. Few skyscrapers, you know, will stand if there isn't a first floor. Okay. Oh, that's right. It was just one other little thing I was going to bring up before we went on. Okay, so the fact that you have with these first three adjectives, individuality, associativity, unity, and you notice that they said fidelity endowment on the third. And like I said, you know, okay, the root word is faith there. Okay, think about, I told you these are, you know, you can think of these as shadows to some degree of what's going on in the upper domain of the hourglass. You're the higher spiritualized mind. Okay, well, you know those three floors that are up there, the fourth, fifth, and sixth levels of meaning, those are established by the first, second, and third cosmic intuitions. Okay, which are individuality, associativity, unity. You know, also, that's the distinction there. The top one, spiritual insight, okay, that your personal recognition through that conduit of that insight is technically faith. Okay? So think about, you know, that basic foundation of objective recognition, the logical acumen, the first cosmic intuition. We talked about recognition very definitively with the first one. Notice in the second one, they say rapid judgment, the moral discrimination, the judicial discrimination, as they say, the second cosmic intuition, the fidelity endowment, faith. Notice the parallel, see, where you can see a more eternalized threefold pattern step down into very temporal in the moment expressions in those first three adjectives. Okay, see, so again, the fidelity, the foundation of faith, basically the shadow of faith down in time. I mean, so see, you're being fundamentally unfaithful, fundamentally misdirected, willfully misdirected in your use of personality if you do that. Again, it's just, don't be surprised if you never recover from such an act. all right, let's see here. Let's go on to the fourth here. So when we go to 4, 5, 6, you know, as I annotated on here, now you're long-term adjutants. You know, basically you're trying to go from being, like the fly that has sort of a 1 second attention span, you know, this short attention span theater that you have as a little child. You're trying to go to fully eternalized consciousness. So, you know, you just see this as you go up, it goes from very in the moment to a little more long-term, a little more eternalized, a little less merely experiential and a little bit more of an existential sort of a quality to what's going on, okay, as you go to 4, 5, and 6. But you're going to do individuality, associativity, unity again, and now in a more long-term perspective.
4, the spirit of knowledge, the curiosity mother of adventure and discovery. The scientific spirit, the guide and faithful associate of the spirits of courage and counsel, the urge to direct the endowments of courage into useful and progressive paths of growth.
Okay. Knowledge again is obviously a human word. Okay, I mean, that's basically, where you're taking the ideas and you're starting to systematize them, more. And so it's even more of a human thing than merely ideas. In the scientific spirit, like they're saying, this is the scientific impulse. This is trying to punch you upward. To be, have a genuine, objective relationship with individuality in the cosmos. Curiosity, mother, adventure, and discovery, etc. Now, the word that I annotated there is ideology. Now, that's a tricky one. If you've kind of only heard that being used in, most of the time in common parlance, you think, isn't that a negative word? Now just literally, as a word, ideology, that's, in a full sort of scholarly sense, you might say, that's the study of the logic of ideas. Okay. You say, I thought these were words you picked so that I could really kind of appreciate it in an animal. Okay, that sounds still pretty human. Study of the logic of ideas doesn't sound too much like an animal. It's like, this was kind of a tricky one to pick a word for. But there's a spirit of ideas. There's that basic impulse, or even more than, there's an urge that is kind of that sort of directs you to the fact of forming an idea in your mind. That individuation, that mental concept, that an animal can have, that has the fourth adjutant. Let's go to mammals, say, where you're definitively going to have a fourth adjutant in play. And where you'll see that is, they're not going to be thinking, I have an idea. They don't think like that. But they have a similar thing of, this is a tool. They'll get the basic idea of a tool, which we would call, I have an idea for how you could use this, right? I always, bring in this one, because everyone's kind of seen chimpanzees do this, they discovered a long time ago that you can take a nice rigid stick of grass and use it as a tool. You dip it down in a termite mound, and pull it out and lick the termites off it. It's a clever little tool, and one of them figures it out, and they go and teach the others, in the group, this tool they've discovered. See, so they discover, it has those shades, but it does, there's no sort of objective awareness of all of it, Well, you can see that, that begins with curiosity, but the key is that tool thing, transcends the moment. The group of chimps, out of any given moment, now have the concept of a tool in their culture. See, notice this is exercising out of the moment. In the previous one, even as a human, I'm courageous just in the moment. This moment needs a courageous act. That isn't a long-term thing, okay? But knowledge, or just the concept of a tool, that transcends the moment. And that's the idea, that those higher animals have the ability to have forms in their mind, and the urges relative to them that are recognized to have usefulness for subsequent moments. They don't think in future terms, but they carry it forward. They don't have to rediscover it each moment. They start to bridge the moments. Okay, only using one of the four, five, or six allows you to begin to do that, to begin to transcend the moment a little bit. You had a question?
Yeah.
There?
Remember when they talk about Andon and Fontan with fire,
right,
for instance?
Mm-hmm.
Tool, so yeah. That was their animalistic level at that particular Knowledge or was there wisdom involved?
Right. Well, see, I mean, that's a great example. So if those in the webinar, he's bringing up the whole nest thing with Anna and Infant and the early Andonites. You know, and remember, it took them a long time to figure out that they could make fire in other ways. Okay, because, see, they discovered, just like the chimp kind of randomly discovers, you know, that this works, and then they perpetuate that forward to subsequent moments. But they have very limited ability to step up above it and reflect on it and say, okay, I get the concept of this. Are there other ways that I could achieve that? See, they don't have that much objectivity going on. So it took them a long time to sort of stumble upon, you know, another mode. It's like, oh, well, you know, maybe I could have figured that out earlier. But you know, with Andonites, you know, even that what I was just doing there is very, you know, they had a limited ability. Remember, Andonites are pretty minimal will creatures. They can't even, you know, consciousize the concept of grandchildren. So they have a difficulty internalizing their consciousness very much, you know, and taking this too much out of the moment.
That's the pre-Sangic.
The pre-Sangic Andonites, yes. Yep.
At what spirit level do we develop our philosophic and reflective thinking ability?
We'll get there in a minute on that, okay? So this is the impulse, the scientific impulse. Now, the other thing that's key there, to think about in less human terms, when they say the guide and faithful associate of the spirits of courage and counsel, why do they do that? So trying to get you to understand how in the higher animals you can have a measure of completeness to their nature. You know, to have any significant completeness, I'm going to need to have individuality, associativity, and unity working together in some sort of a synchrony. Okay? They can't have the kind of, you know, long-term unity-like consciousness of the sixth adjutant. That's super animal. And they certainly need some long-term, if you're going to think about it as some sort of a profound, complete phenomenon. So they're saying, well, how does that work? You know, you have the individuality and the associativity long-term with 4 and 5 in the higher animals. They can't get that human-like long-term of the unity-like, but the third brings an in-the-moment unity-like. So you notice what they did? They created a triple out of those, see? An individuality and associativity and a unity. See, they're showing you how, you know, how there can be a completeness, sort of a quasi-completeness that's almost human. All they need to do is take their unity component in that triplet, see, and take it out of the moment. And then we could get something going here that's more human-like. But it's going to it's going to be close. You know, you take an elephant or something, and it's going to start to have something that seems pretty darn close to like having a consciousness of the afterlife or things like that. You know, like we all know, you know, they have that place where they go and they know they're going to die. It's almost like they have this sense of, you know, happy hunting grounds or something, you know. See, so that's why they bring that in. I mean, it's one thing to appreciate that, what that does for you as a human. But just see, think about it in the animal terms, to have that threefold energy of individuality, associativity, unity, that's quasi, human-like. All right, so that's why they threw that in. They say, obviously, that having the fourth adjutant helps with the third, the urge to direct the endowments of courage into useful and progressive paths of growth. Everyone knows that courage could benefit from a little knowledge at times. I want to, you know, always say, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, okay? But think about the flip side. You know, it also says a guide and faithful associate of the spirit of counsel. That whole bit of bringing a little knowledge into your socialization instinct. And the ramifications of that. That's right. We got sidetracked. I got to finish the ideology thing. Okay, so in a human, so you have the study of the logic of ideas, but see, in the animal, it's just that kind of to the extent that an animal could have this, they kind of get a theory about sticks of grass. You know, I have a theory that this could be used as a tool. And they try it out, and sure enough, it works, and they teach it to others. See, it's that just that basic kind of aspect of ideology. You know, the theorizing about idea-like things, okay? But the really important reason for bringing that in is for this, energy's not directed in its, by its own nature. And you literally see this. You go to the dictionary and you look up the word ideology, and it's got two definitions. One positive, one negative. It can be directed upward or downward. You know, if it's the study of the logic of ideas, okay, that's directed upward. And it's a scientific impulse. Okay? That negative mode. Okay? See, if it's not. And the way that happens, the way it gets flipped negative like that, is when we get to the sixth adjutant, you've got an energy of zeal there. If you don't direct that zeal upward to ideals, but if you direct it downward to ideas, it turns that idea into an ideology in the negative sense. It ismizes it. It gives it that quasi-religious fervor to it. Okay, so bringing in that alternative ideology is very helpful to appreciate. You know that's what, you know, what most people think of as religion is not. It's ideology in the negative sense. It's the misapplication of your sixth adjutant as an energy to an idea or a system of ideas. All right, so that's, see, it's important to have those other words be easy to think about as being oriented up or down. You know, whereas knowledge is definitively upward. Okay, counsel. Again, in that human sense of counsel, it's an upward thing. But before you read it, just, it's the energy of socialization. And we all know socialization could have some negative aspects. Let's read a little bit and think about that.
5, the spirit of counsel. The social urge, the endowment of species cooperation, the ability of will creatures to harmonize with their fellows, the origin of the gregarious instinct among the more lowly creatures.
Okay. Well, so the first part, harmonizing with one's fellows, spirit of counsel, yep. But think about the energy urge there, just that urge to socialize. Okay, the gregarious instinct among the lowly creatures or humans functioning in a lowly mode. Let's say you want to gang up on someone. Those mindal forms cannot exist in your mind without the fifth adjutant. You have this consciousness of the power of numbers, of working in a social unit because you have the fifth adjutant. And you go, ooh, that could be used, to augment my selfish desires, or to smite my fellows. There's strength in numbers, we could do that wolf pack thing and take down a moose, okay? One of us alone can't take down the moose, but the pack can. Right? How dicey it is when we're getting up to an energy now that has a lot of potential, And so the double-edged sword becomes more and more profound. When you start to have the fifth adjutant functioning in a collective mode, in the leading edge of civilization, socialization manifested some very negative ways. You know? And you make isms out of that, socialism, you know, or the socialistic aspect of communism. I see those, you know, you're using that collective expression of this fifth adjutant in a very negative mode. You know, we know what kind of destruction that wreaks. Because now you're starting to get, you know, at its highest levels, you're getting really close to a long-term unity manifestation. You could begin to disrupt the unity. You're on the threshold of evil. Right? If there's going to be evil, you have to have a relationship to unity, and you have to be able to break it, the unity. Okay. And so things are, you know, this, as you go from the fifth to the sixth, it's all the more definitive. This better have some over-control. You better not just be letting this thing randomly orient. You know, and really having nothing but a bottom-up urging to somehow direct it, you know, so that your basal instincts, you know, become socialized. And that fifth, that sixth adjutant, the reason there are no stable creatures in the universe that have just six adjutants, it's either five or seven, is it's fundamentally unstable. You cannot give someone without over control the sixth adjutant. If a human has has severed their relationship with the over control, you know, by disrupting their mindal energy, severing their encirclement in the Holy Spirit and everything, disconnecting from the seventh adjutant, you're going to have to put that thing down because that's completely uncontrollable. You can't have the energy of zeal with no governor. That's worse than the fifth adjutant unregulated, you know, the rogue male elephant. Okay. You know, we all know that if you get that, you know, you get up to the fifth adjutant and that goes rogue, and there's not much, you know, that humans can do with one of those animals, you know, if they're not, you know, if they've gotten misdirected, you have to just put it down. Well, it's even worse when you go up to the sixth adjutant. And so, you know, it's the no man's land. And in terms of evolution, remember they said, remember these come into sequence in evolution? Okay, so 450 million years ago, you have the first animals. You know, the first adjutant engages. Okay, so 450 million years, you know, and over that course, I mean, eventually you get the second and the third. Okay, you get the fifth. Okay, so how long does it take in the evolutionary scheme, to go from having a creature with the fifth, getting the sixth, and then getting the seventh. How long did Anand and Fanta have just the sixth?
Not long.
Oh. One year. 450 million years compared to 1 year.
449 million.
All right. 1 year. See, it's so, I mean, so just, you know, it helps you to appreciate. You can go 100 millions of years with, you know, less than that, but you can't go very long with just a six. You need to get that seventh in there. You need a governor in there quick. You know, so evolutionarily, they was only allowed to be present by itself for 1 year. And the seventh was there. Yeah.
Would that mitigate our capacity to be programmed and indoctrinated? So that we're not behaving, we have no oversight when you're indoctrinated from the time you're very young into some idea, mm-hmm. and you have an ideology, there's nothing that can be done about it without maybe the seventh. Maybe this is an illustration.
Well, not the seventh in and of itself, because it's still subjective. So you're going to need some objectivity to properly guide. But the seventh is the doorway. I mean, the objective consciousness that knows what's the true direction is up there in the upper domain of the hourglass, is being acquired through your three cosmic intuitions. Okay? And that's brought down to direct these adjutants through the seventh. The seventh is the means. It's not the source.
Right.
It's the means. The prudence that, you know, that rules the adjutants, you know, is coming through the seventh. You know, but you want it to be not just mere wisdom, but spiritual wisdom, quote unquote, a spiritualized mind in the objective consciousness coming down through the wisdom and governing the other adjutants. And certainly telling that sixth adjutant that you are not to direct any of your urges downwards or even sideways. I want you rock solid, stick straight upward. Okay? And you take a hold of that sixth adjutant and you do not let it go anywhere except straight up to ideals and to God so that it can be the spirit of worship, not an energy of zeal, you know, running rampant through your adjutant mind. Okay. All right. So that, yeah, it starts to get, you know, you can start to feel a little scared when you think about the fifth adjutant being used negatively. You know, some pack hunting you. Okay. And it's just, you know, we want to appreciate why we have this higher stuff, because these things start to become, you know, problematic if they aren't, you know, being, you know, guided. We start to have psychological terms like sociopathic if this fifth adjutant is not well directed, psychopathic if the sixth adjutant is misdirected, and those are not positive terms.
What about jihad?
Right, I mean zeal, just, you know, zeal of any sort.
That's
right.
What I was
right. Yeah. Yep.
That 1 year.
Yes, that was one Earth year, yes.
Okay.
That was one of our years.
Sure.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Maybe just, you know, as long as I mentioned that, you know, like sociopathic, you know, just remember that means social disease. See, you know, this is the energy of socialization. It's misdirected. You have social disease. Okay. All right, sixth adjutant.
Sixth, the spirit of worship. The religious impulse, the first differential urge separating mind creatures into the two basic classes of mortal existence. The spirit of worship forever distinguishes the animal of its association from the soulless creatures of mind endowment. Worship is the badge of spiritual ascension candidacy.
Okay, so definitely, you know, we get the positiveness about that. But as an energy, it's the energy of zeal. No animal has zeal. No voracious carnivore has zeal. To say that is to anthropomorphize the animal. Okay. Zeal is a greater urge than anything that an animal can muster. So reserve it for the most problematic elements of the animal origin blobs of protoplasm that you see like me. Okay. And the issues I could manifest. Yeah. Right. Zealot, yes. Any zealotry. Okay. Now it's the religious impulse. It's not religion. It's just the impulse. It's designed to punch you up into, you know, objective mind where true religion is. It's the kind of impulse that gets you in relationship with that phase of, you know, of the whole that is associated with true religion. Historically, you know, what do they tell you, point blank, you know, about the sixth adjutant? By and large, all of evolutionary religion is only religion, so-called. It's just manifestation of the sixth adjutant. It's a religious impulse. It's not religion, okay? But you can be positive about it, and, you know, well, we're pre-human, and so it's sort of pre-religious. Well, it's evolutionary religion, okay, but see, more precisely, no. By and large, you know, it's just a sixth adjutant phenomenon throughout history. It's a religious impulse. And everything is fine if you have some, you know, doesn't matter if it's goofy, just some, you know, any notion of God, at least that impulse is directed to something you're trying to understand as God. But if you throw out God, okay, I mean, you can't turn this adjutant off. That zeal is going to go somewhere. It's going to find some idea, okay, and it's going to turn into an ideology, quasi-religious phenomenon, like all of the even things that are called religious are really quasi-religious phenomena. Okay, and you're going to have something that is effectively religion. No matter how much you reject religion, no matter how atheistic you think you are still, you know, using the sixth adjutant just as much as those people that you disparage. It's just that, you know, you've depotentialized your activity. You know, you're consciously trying to turn it away from anything that smacks of God. Okay? When it just, you know, it's like, you know, even in sort of more passive things, like we said about, you know, evolution, you turn it away from the magic man, ta-da, it turns into magic matter. I mean, you don't get rid of that magic notion. You just even more inappropriately misdirect it. Okay, so that zeal element.
The way you were talking about that just so emphasizes how genetics is just basic grasp on this evolutionary, this progress of the adjutants.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, beginning to understand this is, you know, especially when you get to the sixth, it starts to get really important to understand this. Again, we're talking about something that is just an energy. So the moment you were conceived, they calculated how the sixth adjutant would manifest in you. All of what you think is just religious, that was all calculated in advance. Thing that you would pop into your head, basically. You know, with the asterisk, you know, we are humans by grace, so there might be a little something that sneaks in there, but it's going to be lost in a cacophony of stuff that is all calculable. It's just an energy phenomenon. What you're going to be zealous about, what quantity and quality, you know, of that zealotry you're going to manifest, all of that is precisely calculable. Which religious group you're going to pool into, you know, that's all trivially obvious to them, to your angels, the moment you're conceived.
Where's free will coming?
Right, see, that's the whole thing. It's sad to record that, you know, even though free will can't come in a lot in a material creature, it could certainly come in a lot more than it, you know, tends to, because no one is taking delight in trying to take a hold of these adjutants and direct them. You know, and the more you think that you should be spiritual and not religious, okay, the less possibility there is for any direction. Okay, if you're throwing out personality, there's not going to be no personality directing spirit, you know, grabbing a hold and directing spirit, so that spirit's not going to direct mind. You're just going to let your spiritual, your sixth adjutant, direct itself. Well, that's going to be wonderful for everyone. A fire hose with no fireman, you know, this sixth adjutant flailing around in the world, okay? I mean, don't be surprised if we have to put you down, okay? I mean, you know, that's just not, a society can't have that.
You hear it a lot.
Right, you know.
Maybe it's
semantic.
So. But the thought is, nobody's going to choose us anyway.
Right. You know, they know that they'll twiddle their thumbs during your mortal life. But maybe because they don't really think about you temporally. right. I mean, they're choosing an eternal you, not a temporal you.
You know, genetically, you were saying that in, subjectively, I'm looking at this, but in my family, there's no genetic, similarity with all of our, these last two, worship and wisdom. I mean, I went a totally different way.
than they did.
Right. How did they use their sixth adjutant? Did they use it to become very wealthy, for instance?
I mean,
everyone uses their sixth. It's like, you know, we all have it. We're all using it. It's going to be the dominant thing, you know, as a fancy animal in all of our lives. I mean, just, you know, so you can just go from one human to the next and just, you know, appreciate there's not going to be much seventh adjutant or cosmic intuitions in play. Okay, so you basically have this thing with a sixth adjutant at its peak, you know, motivating the whole structure below, you know, and it just picks some direction, you know, and, you know, they're very successful in that direction because they have just this boundless zeal that they pump into that. You know, they make all kinds of money, or they're
the same kind of energy there from the genetics, but just going a different direction.
Right. Yeah. You know, and like I was emphasizing, I mean, those, you know, in general, if you think historically about religious people, you know, you say, well, you know, you shouldn't direct the sixth adjutant to the idea of money. Oh, so I should direct it to false ideas of God? Well, no, my ideas about God aren't false. Yes, everyone's ideas about God are false. That's, their ideals might not be, but their ideas are. I mean, that's why we have the fifth epical revelations, because no one has proper ideas about God.
There also be another reason we have the fifth epical revelation, and that is, according to the theory, it had to be just as calculable that there would be individuals in the last three generations for whom this was insufficient.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And that therefore the Urantia book was absolutely necessary.
Yeah, you bet.
To be there for people that would be hungry for that and would be starving without it.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, don't misunderstand me. Don't say that that's the only reason it's here or something. I mean, no, it's here for many, many reasons. But, but that one element. I mean, obviously, the positive reasons, you know, are what we want to focus on. This is a complicated thing, why it's here. They're hoping that the people that can do something positive with it do, as opposed to just those who are basically using their spiritual consciousness in a negative mode or in a falsely directed mode, just use this to amp up their, the zeal of their misdirection. Because now I think I'm in possession of the fifth epical revelation, I'm going to be even more zealous about my, ideologies. I mean, you don't want to do that with it. that's new wine in old wineskins. Is there a question?
If one eliminates their zeal, can they become more courageous and unwittingly become more loyal?
If you want to be more loyal, you need zeal. But see, what do you want to be loyal to? You want to be loyal to ideals. And you want to direct that zeal at ideals, not at an idea. God wouldn't have given it to you if it's something that you need to throw away. You know, this is a test to see if you can figure out which one of the adjutants you're supposed to throw away. That isn't what's going on, okay? Which one of them is innately bad? The only way to come into relationship with God is with this incredibly potentially destructive energy called the sixth adjutant. You know, God is a long ways above you. If you're gonna have any ability to begin to touch that fact, you're going to need something that can punch you really hard from the bottom up, okay? An impulse within you that can hit you like no other hammer can. It's got to be able to pound you, like that. And it's like at the carnival, at the fair, and you try to slam that hammer down and get that thing to go up and ring the bell. I mean, you need something that has enough energy that it'll actually go up and ring the bell. The other adjutants don't have enough oomph.
So you know how we had, I don't mind transformation.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
So are we going to keep having those?
Well, I mean, the passion is always going to be there. You know, it just is going to, you know, come, you know, quickly in terms of your ascension scheme, come under complete control. I mean, it's under complete control by the time you fuse. Okay, but you will have, you know, fully, you know, in your hands, and then it'll continue to turn up the volume on it as you go up. You know, this incredible energy, you know, that's powering you upward. The zeal that it's going to take to get you to punch all the way through to get up to paradise. Think about that. I mean, we talked about that when we were going through Havona. You know, how much zeal it's going to take, you know, to punch you up to get to the third circuit. It's like, well, okay, that's all negligible compared to, okay, you've got to go up, you've got to go above supreme, through absonite, ultimate, you know, co-absolute, to absolute. I mean, those second and first circuits are going to take so much oomph to power you up that vertical climb. Right, you need this kind of energy.
Did the conductors of worship then have to do something when it got liberated?
Right, and then there's those sorts of things too. Right, see, I mean, obviously it's still there, even on paradise. You have, you know, passion, you know, you'll have passion we can't even imagine right now. You know, the size of the fire hose that you'll have a hold of is beyond our comprehension, okay? But you'll have it completely, rigidly in your grasp. All right, just one other little thing there. So the first differential urge, see, they're reminding you of the differential urge thing again. And so it's still just an energy. Okay, separating mind creatures into the two basic classes of mortal existence, the spirit of worship forever distinguishes the animal of its association from the soulless creatures of mind endowment. Okay, so, you know, literally just animals, soulless creatures, the beasts. Okay, but you notice that they still didn't call you a human. You know, it's still the animal of its association, if all you have is the six. But if you want to be a little more precise, I mean, technically you're a super animal, but you're subhuman. Okay, when you, you know, so at that some point prior to six, when you, your mom was really starting to have a hard time keeping you quartered. Okay, when there was that sixth adjutant and you were zooming. Okay, you know, technically you're a super animal at that point, but you're still subhuman. Yeah, and it's becoming more and more obvious that you're in need of a governor. You know, because you're starting to hit the wall really hard. Okay, but you've just got this unregulated sixth adjutant burning in you. All right, I think we'll probably just do the seventh here, and then we'll wrap it up for the evening.
Seven, the spirit of wisdom, the inherent tendency of all moral creatures to towards orderly and progressive evolutionary advancement. This is the highest of the adjutants, the spirit coordinator and articulator of the work of all the others. This spirit is the secret of that inborn urge of mind creatures, which initiates and maintains the practical and effective program of the ascending scale of existence, that gift of living things which accounts for their inexplicable ability to survive, and in survival, to utilize the coordination of all their past experience and present opportunities for the acquisition of all of everything that all of the other six mental ministers can mobilize in the mind of the organism concerned. Wisdom is the acme of intellectual performance. Wisdom is the goal of a purely mental and moral existence.
Okay, before I forget, that loose end, they were asking about what about, you know, getting to a personal living philosophy. Okay, this acme of intellectual performance, the peak of your intellectual performance. Okay, so with the fourth, you had the scientific impulse. The fifth, you had the social impulse. The sixth, you had the religious impulse. What's the seventh?
Philosophic
the philosophic impulse. Right? I mean, just literally, you know, as a word, what does philosophy mean? Right?
Love
of wisdom. Right? You know, again, we you know, if you think of the fourth and sixth adjutants as scientific and religious impulses, you know, side by side on the second level of meaning, okay, they're super additive consequence. On the third level of meaning is the philosophic impulse. You know, this, you know, the, you know, so many people say, I don't understand why the sixth adjutant is the spirit of worship and the seventh is the spirit of wisdom. Shouldn't it be the other way around? Okay, who's saying that? That's your spiritual consciousness bias, wanting to put religion on top. No, religion's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. Philosophy is an end in itself. Okay? Because, you know, what is true worship? Instead of just the impulse to worship, what is actual worship? Okay? What is that sixth adjutant trying to punch you up to on the sixth level of meaning, you know, the level of true worship? That's the level where you can think the truth. True worship is thinking the truth. It's what the masters of philosophy teach you to do on the highest levels so that you can worship. You know, what do you do after the masters of philosophy make you the acme of your nature? You exercise that nature. You think the truth on an absolute existential level. And the absolute beings resonate with your action. Okay, the conductors of worship don't teach you how to worship. The masters of philosophy teach you how to worship. The conductors just conduct that worship. Okay, you know, so right. I mean, that's so key to making the transformation from all of human history into the fifth epical revelation, you know, to appreciate that what you're initially striving for just wholly subjectively is to get up to the acme of subjectivity, the philosophic impulse. And that's the doorway into the upper domain. The foundation of philosophy and that's what it's all about. You know, that's a very different thing, you know. So people who've been trying to punch themselves up into the top by just being religious, and they can't understand why they haven't been successful. Why does it still seem like, in very short order, I'm right back and I'm struggling with the same issues, and it seems like I'm not religious anymore, you know, and I've got to go to confession or something. I got to do something to make up for my animal origin urges manifesting again. It's because you tried to punch, you know, if here's the hourglass, you tried to punch through the walls to get up into the upper one. No, you have to, there's only one doorway, and it's not a religious doorway, it's a philosophic doorway. Okay, until you bring science and religion together so that you're underneath the opening, then when they get punched, then you go up. But if you try to punch science up or religion up, you hit the ceiling and bounce right back off, and you find yourself down in the morass of your subjective mind again in very short order. You just reflect off the ceiling because you aren't under the doorway, you aren't under the opening. Only when you bring them together can you go up.
And the super additive.
Right, the super additive of that. Yep. No, go ahead.
So I always think philosophically, you know, I think it's more mind-altering. Spiritual, and you know, I think of spiritual as being higher than just mind-altering, physical mind-altering.
Yeah, yeah.
So, is what you're saying, you know, when you reach that philosophical apex, is that a mind-altering experience, or is that ending up, you know, breaking through into this, or is it both?
Well, what did Jesus call the third level of meaning? He called it the level of mind. The doorway he called the level of mind. So, Oh, so it's mind in a more objective, truer sense. Initially, when you're relating to things from a bottom-up point of view, you have the, I'm material, I'm trying to reach up through mind towards spirit. So you have this functional relationship that has that hierarchy. Okay, but objectively, that's not the way those three energies are related to one another. Objectively, you have material energy, and right next to it, you have spirit energy. For instance, you have the Isle of Paradise, and on the same plane, you have the eternal sun. Okay, those are on a plane, side by side. Mind is the superadditive consequence of the relationship between matter and spirit. Okay? You may initially relate to it as a mediator, you know, but to finally objectively recognize that that you aren't going vertically up like this, you know, actually you're going up and down. You have to go up and then get back down to spirit. And it's like, well, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, well, it's because it just can't make sense from the bottom point. It won't make sense until you're up above. And then, you know, you reach down directly into mind and then bifurcate over to individuality and unity. How do you form a true science and a true religion? You don't do it from the bottom up. You do it from the top down. You get a true philosophy, and then you direct that towards individuality and get a true science, and you direct that towards unity and get a true religion.
Got it.
It's top down, okay? Everything changes once you actually get up. You know, then you begin to relay things more objectively. But, you know, I just, you know, quickly here, we'll wrap it up. You don't want to forget, though, that when you're talking about just the seventh adjutant in and of itself, you know, before you have an upper domain of the hourglass, before you're encircled in the Holy Spirit, you know, you have no three cosmic intuitions, but just that split second, you know, the seventh adjutant just in and of itself is still wholly subjective. You know, so just in and of itself, don't expect wisdom out of it. Okay? It's the energy of symmetry. In terms of just what it is an energy, and that's why I have that, you know, alternative word there next to the spirit of wisdom on the chart. It's the energy of symmetry. You know, when they're talking about how it works with the other adjutants, okay, in terms of just what it does in a downward direction, it looks down to the other six and it says, okay, we need some balance and proportion here, guys. I don't see symmetry here. Okay, need a little less of you. Turn your knob down. I need a little bit more of you. This is a timid soul. We need a little more courage here. Etc. So it makes things symmetric. It tries to get the football shaped thing into a basketball shaped structure. That adjutant mind. So, and it just does that as an energy. That's just what it does. You can calculate it. You know, so that they can look at where the other six adjutants are just genetically, and you know, by that time, you know, there's some nurture that's fed in too. You know, so nature and nurture have got the six adjutants set to a measures, certain directions. They know if you put the seventh adjutant energy into that, exactly what it's going to do mechanically, sort of, you know, with those, how it will try to, you know, begin to urge it symmetric, okay? And so the fact that it has that symmetry urge is just natural. Once you have some objective consciousness and you look down at that and you look at what that energy is doing, how it's having a tendency to make things symmetric, you go, oh, I can follow that. You know, let me choose to foster that. Because I understand now, and I have knowledge about that now, and you know, you're thinking about the adjutants more objectively, and you're going to start to follow suit with what God started. Not to mention that initial thread of objective encirclement that you're given by grace, which helps you to have, you know, a vantage point where you're not just sort of following the seventh adjutant, because, you know, think about that. It's like, wait a minute, Chris, you've been saying that these things aren't self-directed. Yeah, see, well, see, technically, right, you're given an initial thread of direction that comes, feeds down, and sort of is motivating that seventh adjutant. So, you know, but you have a hard time being initially aware of the objectivity, because that's at eye level. But you can look down to and see what the seventh adjutant is doing once you're above it.
It's not the part of God, right?
Right, yeah, we have no thought of just here. Just this encirclement of the Holy Spirit, giving you that initial self-consciousness. You know, so, you know, like I was saying, you know, once you finally have something above the seventh adjutant, that thread of objective, spiritualized mind that you can stand on, that's at eye level. So you're a drop of water in the ocean in it initially. You have no awareness of it directly. But you can look down and see the entire adjutant self. You can be conscious of the whole seven adjutant structure, you're self-conscious. You're conscious of the whole self. Okay. But it's just a higher level of the kind of consciousness that an amoeba has of its mechanical mind. But now you've taken it all the way up. And you see the whole lower to the main of the hourglass, you know, when you gaze down. Okay. But it's important so just one other thing there. It's important, though, to never lose sight of just in and of itself, the seventh adjutant is subjective. So that symmetry, or that, you know, that symmetry, that balance and proportion. The simplest thing you can think of that energy doing is it puts the thought in your head, the urge in your head. You go, well, on the one hand, I have six of one, but on the other hand, I have half a dozen of another. You know, it'll give you, the seventh adjutant will make your hands do this. It'll make you think, well, should I do this or should I do that? Without the seventh adjutant, you'd never do that. You'd never think of putting things in scales like that and weighing them against each other. It's that balance and proportion instinct, okay? But it can't decide by itself. You need some objective discriminator above that. You know, like if what you're saying is this right or is this right? You need a moral discrimination, an objective recognition of right and wrong above that, that speaks down to the seventh adjutant and says, it's the one in the right hand. Okay? How do you know? I just know. Okay. and then it directs the other adjutants to do what they need to do, you know, based upon the initial assumption that what's in the right hand is the right thing to do and that this was wrong.
Why do you not call that rationalization? Because I think of weighing, I think of ratios of one to another.
Of course, right. See, obviously the other adjutants are in there too, but I'm just trying to, you know, but just the simple thing of, you're not just connecting dots.
No.
You know, and just going, you know, mindlessly going with whatever direction those two dots, you know, put you in.
That's
eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Right. It's good. Yeah. So technically, see, you know, what you're weighing in the scales there, is it this rationalization scheme or is it this rationalization scheme? You know, and it's got all the other adjuncts in there too. I mean, it's very complicated things that you're weighing. Okay, but the whole thought of trying to weigh them against each other.
Moral dilemmas come to mind.
Right. I mean, see, and you, right, that's a moral dilemma, see. But moral dilemmas can be resolved if you're human. Fancy animals can't resolve them. They just get stuck. You know, it's like, oh, I can't act. I can't figure it out. No, you don't want to admit that you're incapable of penetrating that fog.
You need more study.
you know, don't think it's impossible. Okay? Yes, you're right. You know,
no, we just need to talk.
You need to take delight in cultivating. You can know right from wrong. Okay? Yeah, but there's, you know, but there's, you know, we don't go off on that tangent, but there's details about that. There's issues of eternity related to time and stuff that you got to bring in. You blur those, it gets confusing. Technically, right and wrong choices are not specific to time or space. And that gets people confused. I mean, right and wrong choices have to be turned into true and false decisions that relate to specifics of time and space. That's another story. But anyway, Okay, so there's the adjutants. I had a suspicion it might actually take us the whole time, and plus, you know, to get through those. But I hope you understand those a little bit better than that. And we'll wrap up this section the next time. Let's take a moment here.